Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, April 30th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Yesterday, as Christian said, was the case of Glossop versus Gross. This is an unusual case for the Supreme Court in terms of Eighth Amendment law. It's one of the very few that is concerning what the Eighth Amendment is really about, which is whether a particular punishment is cruel and unusual, as distinguished from the usual Eighth Amendment case where they're talking about questions of procedure and proportionality that have been engrafted on later. So it has to do with methods of execution. And throughout history, the U.S. Supreme Court has never disapproved a method of execution that was actually in use in the United States. Back in the 19th century, the court had cases on firing squad and electric chair, and it said that these methods were not cruel and unusual, that phrase referred to methods of execution such as those that have been used in England, where an intentional infliction of extreme pain was added on to death itself as part of the punishment. That was pretty much the state of the law up through the early 90s. In 1992, there was a challenge to the gas chamber. It was in California's first execution in the modern era. It got to the Supreme Court, but the court tossed it out as having been brought at the last minute. But there was a dissent in that case that said that the gas chamber was now considered cruel and unusual because it was so relative to other alternative methods that were available and that all the experts said were so much better. The alternative was lethal injection, which is exactly what's been under attack in the more recent cases. After that case, states did go to the three-drug method for lethal injection. That three-drug method initially used sodium thiopental, a barbiturate, to render the inmate unconscious, followed by pancuronium bromide, which is a paralytic to prevent any jerking motions, and followed by potassium chloride, which would stop the heart and actually cause death. That was the method that went to the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of Bays versus Reese in 2008. And there the court addressed the question of whether it mattered, whether there were better alternatives available. In that case, the plurality opinion, which just about everybody thinks is controlling now, said it could be an Eighth Amendment violation if a method has a demonstrated risk of severe pain that is substantial when compared to known and available alternatives. But the method in use, they said, did not meet the standard. That is, it was constitutional. Now, the problem with sodium thiopental, it was only made by one company in the United States. That company moved its production to Italy for unrelated reasons and immediately came under pressure from the Italian government, forcing it to get out of the business of making that drug altogether. A lot of states switched to pentobarbital, and many other states, in addition to switching to pentobarbital, got rid of the second and third drugs and just used a massive overdose of the barbiturate to both anesthetize and to cause death. And that is, in fact, the way veterinarians put animals to sleep every day in America. The manufacturer of pentobarbital again came under pressure and put resale restrictions on the drug so as to make it unavailable to corrections departments for this purpose. So some states have changed to another drug called midazolam, and that's been substituted in Oklahoma for the first drug of the three-drug protocol. The thiopental that was at issue in Bays, the Supreme Court said, would put a person in a coma-like state so that he could not feel any pain whatever. The plaintiffs in the challenge to the midazolam protocol say that midazolam can't do that. It can't put a person in a coma-like state. And they point out that it's not generally approved as the sole anesthetic drug for major surgery. There wasn't really any direct testimony that the use of this method necessarily would cause severe pain, however. So the district court denied the claim, found that they had not met the Bayes standard for finding a protocol unconstitutional, and found that it was nearly certain that the person would be unconscious when the second and third drugs were injected so as to not be in pain. The Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit affirmed that decision. The plaintiffs then went to the U.S. Supreme Court. There were four of them at the time. The lead plaintiff, Charles Warner, had an execution pending imminently. The Supreme Court denied him a stay of execution by a 5-4 vote, with a very sharp dissent by Justice Sotomayor, and he was executed. It was widely reported in the press that he said that his body felt like it was on fire. What was not quite so widely reported was that he said that before the lethal injections had actually been pushed and he was just on the IV with saline. So that was likely a case of fakery rather than an actual failure of the protocol. So the questions presented as the case comes to the U.S. Supreme Court are three. One, whether this protocol is permissible given the inability to put a inmate in a coma-like state, whether it presents an unconstitutional risk of pain, whether the Bayes standard applies to all challenges of this type or only the particular protocol in Bayes, and third, whether a prisoner making a challenge must establish that there is available a better formula for carrying out these executions. That brings us to yesterday's oral argument. It was a highly contentious oral argument, even for the Supreme Court. On the question of whether the defendant or the plaintiff must show an acceptable alternative and an available alternative, one of the questions that came up during the argument is what relevance there is to the fact that the alternatives, although they exist, have been rendered unavailable by a concerted attack on them by the anti-death penalty crowd. It was asked by Justice Alito, should the courts be a party to what amounts to a guerrilla war against the death penalty by first rendering the alternatives unavailable and then saying a method is unconstitutional because it's not as good as those alternatives? Second question has to do with the factual question regarding the possibility of causing pain and the distinction between whether it can put a person in a coma versus whether it can make him unconscious so as not to feel pain. There's a large amount of factual discussion in the argument. There's a lot of information that has come forward in the briefing at the Supreme Court that was not at the district court level. And at one point, there was a question of whether they should remand for that purpose. The argument I didn't find particularly enlightening. I think it would be extremely unusual for the Supreme Court to reverse a district court on what is essentially a factual finding, particularly when a lot of the facts have come in at the appellate level rather than being in the trial record. We do have this preview of the 5-4 vote on the stay request, and I think most likely result is that the justices will stay at the same position they were on the stay request. I think it will likely be a 5-4 vote for the state, but of course we'll have to see. A decision in the case will be expected probably in late June, just before the court breaks for the summer. And with that, I think we'll go to questions, if anybody has one.
All right. Well, we'll now turn to questions from the audience. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. All right. It looks like we had a couple questions jump on the line, three to be exact. So we'll go to those right now.
Hi. One of the things that the marijuana supporters often say in this argument is, well, why don't you just give them an overdose of marijuana and kill them? And, of course, the answer is, well, marijuana doesn't kill people. But people die of heroin and opium overdoses all the time. So why not just use the simple opium, which they're harvesting in Afghanistan, and is just an ordinary painkiller, probably the most harmless of the painkillers, but you can always overdose on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically sort of along the same line as the pentobarbital method, and I don't know that anybody has really looked into that and whether it would be an acceptable method. I mean, certainly there are lots of effective ways to kill someone if that's your only alternative or your only goal. But whether it would be something that we would consider acceptable for an execution, I don't know of any research on that.
Kent, could you give us any more insight? You know, the swing vote, and particularly on the Eighth Amendment cases, is always Justice Kennedy. Could you give us any more insight into what...
Justice Kennedy was unusually quiet in this argument. He's usually more active. There was the exchange that I mentioned earlier about whether it made any difference that the alternatives had been rendered unavailable on purpose by the opponents of the death penalty, and Justice Kennedy joined in asking that question, and when he didn't get an answer that he liked, he said basically, you haven't answered the question, and pressed on that. And that was all he said during the oral argument. And he was one of the five who voted to deny the stay. So it's a pretty weak basis for predicting a vote, particularly with Justice Kennedy. He's a little less predictable from oral argument than some of the others. But what little indication there is would be that he has not changed his vote and would probably still be on the conservative side of this argument. Okay. Well, let's see if there's something else while we're waiting for further questions.
Well,
there was a lot of...
I'm told I have the floor. This is Bill Otis, and I'm happy to have a chance to talk with Kent and the chance to blog with him on crime and consequences. I have an observation and a question. The observation is that although I certainly agree that it's a dangerous thing to predict votes from oral argument, the fact that Justice Kennedy voted to go forward with the execution, I think makes it quite unlikely that he is going to go in the other direction now, because what that would necessarily mean is that he had voted to permit an execution under a protocol that he would now have to find unconstitutional. Judges will sometimes change their mind, although very rarely, but I think it's extremely unlikely that a justice would change his mind under those circumstances. My question is this, whether Kent thinks there is a possibility of dismissal of this case as improvidently granted based on two grounds. One of those is one that Kent has mentioned, that it's essentially at bottom, this question is a factual one concerning the likelihood of pain. That is not something that the Supreme Court is ideally positioned to resolve. A fact-taking court can better resolve that, and that is the district court. And the second reason that it would be possible to dismiss this as improvidently granted is that I understand Oklahoma has now changed prospectively its method of execution and is using a different cocktail of drugs. So the argument is that a decision here would be either moot or advisory, but in any event, that the writ as it stands was improvidently granted. I was wondering whether Ken had a view of that.
Okay, I have actually three there. Let me just comment on the first comment. I don't doubt that Justice Kennedy would change his vote if he had actually been convinced that he was wrong the first time, but I don't see any visible indication that he was. Dismissal as improvidently granted is a possibility, because I do think that a majority of the court does think they shouldn't have taken it, and that's why they voted to deny the stay. But since they have gone ahead and taken the oral argument, I won't say it's impossible. I think it's not very likely. As far as the new Oklahoma bill, the Oklahoma bill only says that nitrogen asphyxiation is the second in their list of alternatives if the first, which remains lethal injection, becomes unavailable. So there's a chicken and egg issue as far as dismissing this case. If the case is dismissed, then lethal injection remains available in Oklahoma with midazolam, and so the contingency that the nitrogen would kick in isn't there. So I would not believe that is a ground for dismissing this case, and I would hope they would not dismiss the case, because I would like to see the issues underlying this case resolved. despite the factual.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. We apologize for the technical difficulties, but we should have that resolved, and we have three questions pending on the line. So thank you for holding patiently. So now we'll go to our next question.
Hello, this is Mary Campbell Gallagher, and I'm curious, you said that you wanted to see the issues resolved in this case, but I have been wondering from the beginning, really, why the court agreed to hear the case to begin with. Are these issues such so burning, forgive me, no joke intended, that they need to be resolved when the death penalty is constitutional, when there's no real problem? Is there? Or maybe there is, and I don't know it.
Well, the Supreme Court has a quirky little rule that even though it takes five votes to grant a stay, it only takes four votes to take up a case. And so when the court is divided 5-4, as it appears to be in this case, you can get a case accepted for review even though a majority didn't think it was even worth a stay of execution. There are some important issues of law underlying this case. So in addition to the four justices who think that that modiazolam is not a acceptable drug for these executions, we do have these fairly significant issues about what is the legal standard for judging these matters, and what is the relevance of the existence and availability of an alternative. And so those are issues of law that I think should be resolved, and they can only be finally resolved by the Supreme Court to guide what happens in litigation in lower courts going forward. So,
well, the second one, do you mean should the burden be on the condemned person to provide an alternative means of execution? Is that the issue?
That is one of the issues, and do they have that burden and when? And the position I took in my brief, I wrote an amicus brief in this case, is that for inherently cruel methods, such as aren't used in America anymore and haven't been in a very long time, no alternative need be shown. But if your position is that this has become unacceptable through some sort of evolving standard type argument, even though it was acceptable before, and it only becomes unacceptable because there's something better, that yes, you would have to show what the something better is, and it does have to actually be available. That we've gotten to the point with methods of execution that we're not doing things that are inherently cruel, and the executions should go forward. And so if your argument is that something better is available, it should be an either or and not whether the execution goes forward or not.
And could you remind me about what the first branch of an issue that should be decided here is?
They're claiming that the Bayes case required for protocols of this kind that the person be placed in a coma-like state. And in my view, that's not required. All that's required is that he be sufficiently anesthetized that he does not feel extreme pain.
So the question is whether there's a constitutional requirement of coma.
Yeah. That's basically their argument.
Okay. I might wonder whether that was really a constitutional question, but you know your subject.
Well, I mean, I don't think that argument is correct. I don't think it's, but there is, they've seized upon some language in the Bayes opinion that was talking about the particular protocol at issue there, and made the claim that that's what's constitutionally required. And I think refuting that is significant and worth an opinion in this case.
I see. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Well, we still have two questions pending, so we'll go to those now, and then our lines will be open.
Hey, Kent, this is Tom Dettie. Quick question. Assuming it's not dismissed as improvidently, what do you think is the petitioner's strongest argument and anything that might give the court real pause?
The strongest argument, I think, is the weakness of the expert testimony in the district court of the defendants, that is, the state. Their expert did make some significant errors, and it wasn't the best tried case. It was done on a very rushed basis. So it's not a great argument, but particularly when you've got a case where the district court has decided it and the Court of Appeals has affirmed it, and now you're going up to the Supreme Court on what is essentially a factual question. It was noted at the oral argument that they hardly ever do that, reverse on that basis. But that's probably the best they have.
Okay. All right. Well, we have one more question pending, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask a question of our expert about the case and the oral argument, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, yes. My name is Mike Mitchell. I'm calling from Arizona, Maricopa County Attorney's Office. And I'm trying to find out, this isn't a question directly on the argument, but obviously our state is one that's had some issues obtaining the drug and actually brought to the attention of the Ninth Circuit in Landrigan the economic warfare that was immediately engaged against the Great Britain Company that was supplying some of the thiopental back then. Does anyone listening or any of the presenters have any ideas on why methods to obtain the drugs or alternatives or anything else that can be done to combat the economic warfare that, regardless of the opinion, is going to continue by the abolitionists?
Yeah, I think there are efforts underway to get drugs from other sources. I mean, we had the compounding pharmacies for a while, and now they've been attacked, possibly a source from Asia. Frankly, I would like to see Congress simply outlaw placing of resale restrictions on drugs. I think any seller of pharmaceuticals who doesn't want to sell to departments of corrections would be entitled to not sell to them. But for a seller to place resale restrictions, stopping people further down the chain from selling them, I think is a restraint of trade, and I think it ought to be illegal. So that's something that I think ought to be done. I don't know if the political will is there or not.
Well, we had one more question jump on, and then our lines will be open. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Yeah, this is Bill once again. I have one additional question for Kent, and that is whether you detected that Justice Alito or perhaps other justices in agreement with him might write, say, a concurring opinion talking about the problem of this guerrilla war and how the interest groups trying to suppress the supply of safe drugs for lethal injection are, in essence, trying to enlist the court in a backdoor attack on a penalty, the death penalty, that the court finds to be constitutional, and in essence to hijack the judicial process and the political process simply by what amounts to a ploy of market coercion. I would like to think that there might be a concurrence along those lines. Am I just dreaming?
No, I'd prefer to see it in majority opinion, but
I'm not dreaming that much.
I am. I put it in my brief.
Good for you.
I think it's, for that point to be left out of a majority opinion and appear in a concurrence is something that is quite consistent with, past practice, that kind of denunciation. Because really what they're trying to do here is to create a catch-22 where, you can't use this method because the other method is better, but you can't use the other method because it's been blocked by some other process, as opposed to an outright repeal through the democratic process, which they're not able to do in most states. So I think it is important that the judiciary not facilitate that kind of evasion of democracy.
Well, it looks like we still have two more questions pending now with plenty of time to go, so we'll go right to them.
This is Mary Campbell Gallagher again, and I wondered whether exactly the point of the previous question might have been the reason for permitting the argument in the first place, because from the reports of the oral argument yesterday, the judges really, or some of the justices really took off on this point, Justice Alito, Justice Roberts, and I wondered whether they're arguing against a perverse misuse of the law, of course, but whether it wasn't, in a sense, a rather perverse use of the granting of argument in order to take a case where their main point is that the parties are going about their guerrilla campaign in a guerrilla rather than legal way. Would that be a perverse thing for the Supreme Court to do, or do you think they might do that?
Well, we never really know what the vote was to take the case, or what the reasons for it were, unless they come out years later when somebody's memos are published. But in this case, I think there's a pretty clear indication that it was the four who are leaning the defendant's way, that is the Thrown Inmates' way, who voted to take the case, because we have this vote to deny the stay.
Right.
I'm close to certain that the five justices who voted to deny the stay to Charles Warner, who was originally the lead plaintiff, would not have voted to accept the case and then deny the stay. So I'm
great point.
Close to certain that it was the four who joined the dissent from the denial of stay who voted to take the case.
Good, good.
All right. Well, we have one more question pending, but before we get to that, I want to make a quick programming note. Yesterday, we just scheduled a teleforum for Tuesday, May 5th at 12 p.m. Eastern. That's going to be on Professor Michael Paulson's new book, The Constitution, An Introduction. As some of you may have seen this morning as well, Justice Alito has written a review of the book that is now available on our website and is going to be published in our law journal, Engage. So again, if you'd like to tune in, Professor Paulson, his co-author, who's actually his son on the book, will be on the call, as well as Professor Kevin Walsh from the University of Richmond School of Law will be discussing the book as well. So again, that is Tuesday, May 5th at 12 p.m. Eastern. So, yeah, let's go ahead. We've got one more question pending, and then our lines will be open.
Kent, this is Paul Larkin. It's nice to hear from you again.
Yeah.
I have to apologize. I missed the first few minutes of your opening, and you may have addressed this, but I was wondering, was there any discussion today about alternative methods of execution, such as firing squad or hanging?
Yeah, there was some discussion of that, and some discussion as to whether those would even still be constitutional. Not a lot, but basically some of the justices pointed out that even if we don't go lethal injection at all, there are still other ways to carry out executions. I think those are more in the way of offhanded comments. I don't know that will come out in any of the opinions, but you know, we'll have to wait and see.
Can I just ask a follow-up?
What
you said at the beginning was a little troubling, that there was some indication from some of the justices that those two methods would no longer be constitutional.
There would certainly be challenged, they would certainly be litigated, you never know. I mean, there have been cases in lower courts where methods that had been accepted and used for years were declared unconstitutional. Both the electric chair and the gas chamber were subject of adverse decisions in the lower courts. So I wouldn't be surprised to see those two methods attacked as well.
Thank you, Kent.
Okay. All right. Well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to get on and ask a question or offer a thought, please press star and then the pound key. All right, we have one question that just jumped on.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to follow up on that very point concerning alternative methods. It seems to me that to a certain extent plays into the challenger's hands with respect to the evolving standards threshold. And to the extent that the court were to even entertain that, I was hoping that perhaps you could illuminate us on what you think certain justices, or ideally it would be a clear majority, would seize upon the opportunity here to fully and finally put that to rest, as far as whether or not that's even a threshold that needs to be met as to the reasonableness of alternatives, as to the likelihood of inducing a coma-like state or less pain and suffering, things of that sort, that no longer, or at least could be lessened or outright removed as a threshold showing that could be utilized as a cudgel here by the challengers to continually barrage the court with these kinds of attempts to undermine the methodology imposed.
Yeah, I do think that if the state prevails in this case, we will see an opinion saying no, even though coma-like state was mentioned in the Bayes opinion, that doesn't make it a constitutional requirement. That's not the requirement. The requirement is the absence of severe pain, which is a different thing. as far as the existence of alternatives goes, I hope we'll get a majority opinion clearly reaffirming what Bayes said, which is if you're attacking a method, first you have to make a threshold showing of a substantial risk of severe pain, and only once you've met that does the existence of alternatives even have any relevance at all. So I hope to see a reaffirmance of that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was wondering, is if you thought that there was an opportunity, because while the four that may have voted for this may have thought that they could have used it as an opportunity to illuminate more of what the damaging aspects in their mind, the three drug cocktail that Oklahoma uses, if they could try to make some headway in undermining the overall issue concerning the imposition of death using that drug, that the five now, that the four of them had moved in this direction, that the five justice majority could nevertheless take this and really advance the ball as far as trying to chip away at what kind of attempt there may have been to try to, you know, enable the abolitionists, as Justice Scalia referred to them.
I don't use that term myself, but go ahead.
Right. That they would have nevertheless been trying to chip away at this using that methodology in terms of the reasonable alternative with respect to the pain aspect. Because while there is some degree of ambiguity, and as you said, Bayes, certainly, given the plurality opinion, could arguably set that stage for the challengers to make that argument that this could be crystallized here. And hopefully the majority would have the fortitude to do that. And that's, I didn't know if there was anything...
If the majority holds together, that is the five who voted to deny the stay continue to constitute a majority, then I would expect that the opinion would not produce any movement in the defendant's direction, and may produce some movement in favor of reducing these suits, although I wouldn't expect a large change in the law. I think reaffirming and perhaps strengthening Bayes a little bit would be the most that would come out of it.
Okay. Thank you.
All All right. Well, we've had a very active audience, but we still have more time for questions. So, and the lines are open. So if you'd like to get on and ask a question or offer a comment, you're free to do so now. Again, it's star and then the pound key. And one other programming note I'd like to make is that please put on your calendars that our third now annual Executive Branch Review Conference is going to be held June 18th this year here in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel, and that's an all-day conference. Again, that's the third annual Executive Branch Review Conference, and you can find out more information about that on our website at fedsoc.org. Well, let's do one more last call for questions. So if you have anything you'd like to get in before we conclude, press star and the pound key now. Well, just a reminder to everyone, this podcast or this telephone will be posted as a podcast on our website in the next few days. So you can find this call as well as all of our previous Teleform conference calls available for stream or download at any time on our website at fedsoc.org. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Kent Scheidegger for joining us today, for attending the argument yesterday, and thank you to our audience for your questions and your participation. And until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.